See, on the very back of this, they found this seal. And it was like right here, again, this is the Temple Mount, if you have this. These are the southern steps. And then there's the city of the Gihon Springs, the city of David's down here, David's palace. Even the Jebusites' remains are right here. This was their fortress. This was the original city. Then Solomon expanded up into this area. He built a new palace up here. Then there's a wall, a protective wall, of the northern wall of the early city here. This became a place for royal activity. They had there's a bakery here inside or on the, inside the wall, and as this is going, and it's called the Ophel, O-P-H-E-L. It's the kind of, this is high, but then it rises up here up to the top of Mount Moriah right here. And if you look on page 4 of this, you can see Tony on that very first picture. She's standing, and we're down here outside the city, and she's looking over a lot of area here. And you can see where I've got the bula pointing right here. I've got that pointing right here. So that's right in that area. And then if you go to the picture right below it, now I'm standing right here on the Palace of David right in here. You can go inside and see the remains of the wall. And I'm looking this way. And right up here is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Right there, you can see that up there. That's labeled. And then over here on this side, this picture here, now I'm over here on Mount Olives looking over the Kidron Valley at this part right here. Nonetheless, when they were excavating this just like 2 or 3 years ago, they found many things, but they found within a few feet, you can find the details of it, they found a Hezekiah seal and an Isaiah seal. Now they have found, or they have gotten, see, now what I'm going to show you, these are not authentic. These are imitations. I'll pass this around, but right here is one of the Hezekiah seals that they found before. But they actually found one, and Elot Mazur was the one that found it. Her team found it in an excavation, so it was a scientific excavation. They found the right layer. It was one of the first ones of Hezekiah seals that was found scientifically, not just on the black market somewhere, but that someone found somewhere and they started selling it. So I'll pass this around. And these are imitations. And these are 1, 2, 3, 4. There's Hezekiah's father. There's Hezekiah's son, Manasseh. And these are seals. They found seals of these kings. Now what a seal is if you take say you wrote a document, say like right here, me and Tyler did this on a video the other day. You know, you write a document and then you write it on animal skin or parchment, or that'd be animal skin, but whatever, or papyrus in the New Testament time. And then you'd wrap it up with a string, put a piece of clay right here, and then you'd take your ring and you'd seal it and it'd put your name on it. And you'd have it on a ring, you'd have it on sometimes they'd roll the cylinder on it like this, or they'd have like a little marker like something like this. There's a little stone that they'd wear around their neck that'd be a hole in it. They'd wear it like a necklace. They could just press it down and press it and seal it. Now, again, that's what a seal is. Now, I want to show you this, too. This one, for example, would be a document sealed with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 seals. They couldn't, you know, this is Revelation material. You know, there's sealed with 7 seals. You understand? And they had to break each of the seals to open, to see what was written. See, you can't read it. And if even Isaiah does this, is in the book of Isaiah or Jeremiah, where he buys property, and they would take this and they'd have two documents. They'd have one, it'd be the same thing. You'd have the one that you have at home to say, see, I own the land, right? Here's my contract. And then you'd have the sealed document, and then you'd put that in the temple, or you'd put that somewhere on the file in the bank, somewhere in your safety deposit box. So if you ever had a dispute, you could say, well, I've got a sealed document that's never been opened, and that would be proof that this would be an authentic one. It would prove this was authentic. Does that make sense? And you can see Jeremiah making two seals, or two documents, and they'd seal one, and they'd put it in the temple, which means there was some building somewhere, some room, where there would be volumes of papyri sitting around. And they found one down here when they're excavating just outside the palace of David. It's called the burnt room, and they found just handfuls of these. They're called bula. That's the remaining clay seal with the inscription on it. That's the bula. The seal is what you'd actually press into it. So these, when this would get burnt, if this would get burnt, the paper would be burned up, the string would be burned up, and then this piece of clay would be glazed like in a pottery, and it would be like a little stone. It would never go anywhere. In fact, I have one right here, and you can pass this around. This is real. This is authentic. It's a Roman bula from around between 10 or 200 AD. It was found around in the Israel, but it was a library that got burnt. And so all the paper's gone, but they just found handfuls of these bula. And so you can pass that. You could actually, if you wanted to, you could shake it out, look at it. There's the front. It's got a couple little images on it. It's not like a real good one. But on the back, if you look at the back, you can see the papyrus scratches where they press it in. Like papyrus would be reeds. This is, you know, obviously paper. But then the papyrus would be pressed reeds, so they'd have lines going across it where it was all pressed together. And so when you put a clay on the papyrus, you'd leave some kind of a marking. And you can see on the back, you can actually see the papyrus marking. So this is a real 1800 to 2000 year old seal, bula from a document that was in a library that got burnt. So they found a bunch of them right here, but they also right up here in the offal, just maybe, was it 2 or 3 years ago, they found within, I can't remember if it's like 15 feet apart, they found an Isaiah and they found a Hezekiah bula. Now what I've got right here is I've got in this little, here I'll pass this around, this is an example of a seal, and it's the Isaiah seal. They did not find the Isaiah seal. That'd be something he'd wear around his neck. But they actually found, and this is a replica, they actually found this. I got a little magnifying glass on the top. You can pop it off and look at it. And I'll pass around and I'll explain. On the top, it's flat on the top. You can see the legs of a deer kind of or something, like a fawn grazing. And then there's some words that are written underneath, and I'll show that to you. But I'll pass this around. You can look at this. This is, again, not authentic, but they actually have the Isaiah seal. And it was found right here close to the Hezekiah seal. So there was, again, some kind of official work going on here. All those documents got burned, and they found those bula. Those are bula. The clay is the bula. And I'll pass this around behind it. This is, they just made this up. This is, they just, you know, whatever sealed that had to look something like this. So this is, again, just an example of a seal that matches the Isaiah seal. Now, on your notes here, again, if you look at the very back page, you have the Isaiah seal right here. And if you guess, that's what that sample I'm passing around, the imitation, it's broken off right here, and so you're missing the deer. And they think those are the feet of a deer. You don't know for sure. Some fawn. It was a symbol of prosperity and peace, of a fawn grazing, and that's what that would say. And then across here, they've got these words right here, and I've got to turn the page. Well, here, while I'm looking at it, there's Isaiah 29:11 verse. And the vision of all this has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed, or it'd be a scroll that is sealed. When men say, when give it to one who can read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot, for it is sealed. I can't read it. It's sealed, and they can't open it up. If you go back to, I'm trying to see where, is it on that little print, small print? On this page 5, there's some pictures of it, and you can see the writing going across there. But what it says, the prophet, or Isaiah, the prophet, across there. And there's a couple letters that are missing that would make it, finish it, that it would be prophet. And the Hebrew letters are missing there. So it says, clearly says Isaiah, and looks like belonging to Isaiah, the prophet. But a letter is missing, so it doesn't really say, like I've said before, it doesn't really say, again, this is English, it doesn't really say prophet. It says prophet. It says belonging to Isaiah the prophet. And this is broken off. And so it's like, well, what could it be? If you go through the English alphabet, if you put an A there, it'd be a prophet. Well, that makes no sense. Maybe it's a bee. Prophet, that makes no sense. You do the same thing in the Hebrew. There are only one real letter that makes sense here would be a P, but it's missing. So you anticipate that's a P. And the same thing with Hebrew. The letter that is missing is the only word that would make that, only letter that make that make sense. So it's like 100%. You got some, if you don't want to believe, you don't have to. But it's almost 100% guaranteed that is a seal or a bula from the seal of the prophet Isaiah on a document, most likely shared with Hezekiah, put in the files, and then everything was burnt up in the destruction of, and this burnt house the burnt room was from the destruction of 586, the Babylonian destruction, and the same thing there. So anyway, that's just kind of interesting, because we're talking about Isaiah, and we kind of ended class talking about that. That's just some information about that. And then here on page 3, there's the Hezekiah bula, and that's kind of the sample I'm passing around there. And then the first page, this is some notes I handed out, a couple years ago. And this is just, I talk about Tel El Haman, where Sodom is at, and it's right here on the map. And that's just showing, that's again guaranteed that's Sodom. I mean, that they have located Sodom. They're doing scientific excavation. There's burnt layers. There's a whole discovery there, and there's really no doubt about that any longer being the location. So that's nothing we're talking about, but I just wanted to share that. Any questions or thoughts or comments about that? How's that fit with class tonight? Well, we're talking about the book of Isaiah, and it just came up, and I find those things exciting. Eschatology. I had to stop and think while I spelled that. No. They're like ancient coins. I mean, there's so many of them. They have like mint ones, like mint coins in museums, but after a while, they're just available. I mean, they're just, you can find them. And you got to be careful. There are people, there's frauds out there. So, but if you know the people, like for example, this right here, this Tel Al-Haman right there, this, I know, comes from there. This is authentic. It's a jar handle from the side of a jar. You see how big the jar was. This comes from the time of David at that location. It's in that layer as they were digging down to, comes out of the Iron Age layer, and they're digging down into the Bronze Age layer, which they have reached, and that's the layer of destruction from the days of Sodom. So this was something they had to dig to pass through it. It's right around the time of David on the other side of the Jordan. And this is authentic because I know the guy who took it out of the ground and he gave it to me and brought it back for me. So you got some things that, again, these are replicas here, But there's coins. You can get ancient coins fairly reasonable, the very nice mint ones, and especially if they're pure gold, of course, they're going to be in a museum. But they make them out of bronze. They make them out of sometimes some kind of silver alloy or something. So there's things out there. Any other questions about that?
Seven seals on Revelation.
Right.
They are bing, 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 bing. You have to open all seven in order to open.
Well, you see, that I've heard that taught. What Arlen's talking about is that some people have taught that there were seven seals, and you'd break the first one, and then you'd read a little bit of the document. Then there'd be another seal, and you'd break that, and then you'd read a little bit more of the document until you got all the way through the final part of the document. That's clever. I mean, it's possible. So you got this like sequence of events, but it doesn't make sense because no one sealed documents like that. Like if this is a contract, you got to pay a price. You get to read the first part of the contract, but we need another payment to get to the full edition. And then they have found documents that were sealed several times. Like, for example, it's for two people. Two people have to be there to open it up or whatever. So this is possible, the seven seals like this. Seven seals within a document is, again, that's all these things we're trying to explain them. And so it's like at some point you got to say, this is what I believe, this is what I'm convinced of. But a little more information, you suddenly find something, it's like, well, maybe you got to go back and relook at it. But this is the way the seven seals would have been. They all have to be broken.
Then do you say that those seven seals seals are not really judgments. They are just seals. They're sealed, right.
Yeah, you can't open this up. And this would be, if I wanted someone to open this, if I was going to send this to someone, I would seal this, and it could only be opened by the person it's addressed to. To send it with the servant, and the servant opens it up, it could be his head. I mean, it's a major violation, depending on how serious the deal is. The book of Revelation, talking about the seven seals, is there's a document, there's information that has to happen, that has to be revealed, released, processed to get to the end, but no one can open it. And that's why John, he's weeping. It's like, we're never going to finish this. Kind of like the Old Testament, we go through the Old Testament prophets, it's just failure after failure. Maybe we got a great king, but he's going to fail. Maybe we have these great people, but they're going to fail. Here's a prophet trying to tell you what to do, but it's like we're just in this vicious cycle of mankind just failing. Like the book of Judges, just a cycle of why are we so stupid? It's like, well, here's the end. Here's the answer. But none of us are worthy to finish the book. It's like, there's no end. There's no end to the process of salvation. It's just a continuous anticipation, but no one's coming. But wait, one that appeared as a lamb that had been slain came out, which again, what a graphic image. I mean, what does that look like? A lamb that's been slain. I mean, his neck's been cut, and bleeding all over. He comes out and he's worthy. He takes the scroll and he begins to open it. And now the question's going to come in my teaching and everyone's teaching, but this helps me determine, is he opening up wrath and judgment on the earth by breaking these scrolls, seals open? Some would say, yeah, so the church can't be here during the period of the seals because it's the wrath of God. Okay, and that's fair. That's fair. Because God has not appointed us to suffer wrath. But if he's opening up the end of the process of salvation, that no man is worthy. He looked above and below and under the earth, and no one was found that was worthy to open the seal. But the one that was slain can open the seal and get this thing moving to the end so we can get to the final salvation. And so now all of a sudden these things are not judgments from God or wrath. It's just what's going to take place as we move into the end. And that with the sixth seal, that's when all of a sudden the sign of the Son of Man appears, a throne in heaven, and the world sees it. The unbelievers see it. Hide us from him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And now you basically have heaven in your atmosphere because the throne is in the atmosphere, like what Ezekiel saw. That's why Jesus maybe calls it the sign of the Son of Man, because the one who spoke from the throne in Ezekiel called Ezekiel the Son of Man. So you've got the Son of Man sitting on the throne, but the Son of Man calling Ezekiel Son of Man. So either way, either it's because Jesus is the Son of Man sitting on the throne, or it's what Ezekiel, the Son of Man, saw is the chariot. And then from there, he pours out or plays the trumpets are released, and the bowls are poured out from that place. Now you've got the wrath of God. It's the wrath of the Lamb. But where's the church? The church now has gone up at the sixth seal, when he appears in the sky. And so that puts the rapture into the tribulation. So we, the church, would face persecution, suffering, hardships, which it's like God would never let that happen to the church. It's like, yeah, he did. I mean, all the apostles died throughout church history. That's part of the church's mission, is to proclaim in the face of persecution, which, it's not wrath. It's just the way life is. Well, the trumpets and bowl judgments begin after the seventh one is, when that's opened up, then the judgments, the wrath begins to finalize. That's when we get to Isaiah. We can go through this right now. I want to get going with this, but the same thing there is we've got these promises that there's going to be the seed of the woman is coming and is going to break the power of the serpent. But in the process, he's going to be bruised. So it's going to be a real man who's going to break the power. He's going to be bruised. As we continue through the Old Testament prophecies, we see he's going to come from Abraham, the family of Abraham, from the tribe of Jacob or Judah, from the seed of David. And from there, we see that he's going to be a king. Even from the days of Judah, He's going to have a scepter. He's going to rule the nations. And then as we continue in the Psalms, we find out, Moses talks about the place. There's going to be a place, and we find out it's Jerusalem, where the temple's going to be. And then all these are connected with eternal covenants, or covenants that can't be broken, the covenant of David, the Davidic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, the place that he's promised. And then there's going to have to come this time of, in the end, how does this all have to take place? Well, this seed, this man is going to be a king, who's going to be the seed of the woman. He's got basically two jobs. He's got to break the power of Satan, but he also has, and this is the continuous problem, we're finishing Hosea hopefully tomorrow night, but the continuous problem is the failure of mankind. Mankind is not going to be able to get out of this mess. And so in the process of being bruised, this bruising is somehow replacing us, mankind, or Adam, the seed of Adam, with the seed of the Son of God, who is 100% God, 100% man. We see that in Isaiah. We see it in other places. He is the Lord himself. You know, the Lord has become a man. God has become a man. And he's going to replace our failure with his righteousness, his ability to never fail. And you got the power of Satan is broken. You've got the Lord who is our righteousness. And now he can take all of this and take us into this place of salvation. And this is all that we've seen so far. And now as we continue through Isaiah and Daniel and the other prophets, we start getting details. We call it eschatology, like what's happening in the future. But all of it, this is just, all of this is coming together. And I think with that, it puts limitations on what we can do with this in interpreting the end times. Like when we get to Revelation, you know, instead of jumping into Revelation, which, you know, I've done before, taught verse by verse several times, but instead of just jumping into it, it's like we build this foundation. It's going to give you some limitations on what you can say that means. For example, when it talks about, where the nations, the kingdom on the earth, I mean, nothing in here gives me the impression so far that, like I said before, that this is a rescue mission to just get us off the earth to some safe place in heaven and just abandon this cursed earth to, you know, eternal, just get away from it. It's like this is all talking about this earth being, not just us being redeemed, but the earth being redeemed, of Israel being redeemed, of Jerusalem being redeemed, of restoration, of peace on the earth, of the nations coming to Jerusalem to meet with the Lord, to learn how to walk in the knowledge of God, to go back and restore their nations. And even the church, when they get into amillennialism, if it be the Catholic Church or the Reformed Church, however, you know, wherever you're at, is, well, the church is going to bring some great reformation to the nations. Well, that, again, puts that in the hands of man. Yeah, we're saved, but we've still got a sin nature. I mean, they're even talking about the nations being brought under submission of God through the church, if that would be an example of amillennialism. But that's not going to take place until the king comes and establishes himself right there. Anybody want to ask a question? And then I'm going to get started on this. Anything, does that make sense, what I'm saying? I mean, we got a long ways to go. We got maybe a short time to get there. Depends on what's going on. And again, people talk about end times now. And what's interesting about, and it's, we always talk about end times, you know, it's always a buzz thing in the church, but there are some things happening now, potentially, it depends on how you look at them, that have never happened before, that have never been on the board before. You know, starting with Israel being back, and you know, now you've got some peace taking place in the Middle East, which is interesting. You've got all the technology, and so, you know, I don't want to rush ahead. If we look on the page one of the notes that I handed out last week, does anybody need a copy from last week? It's just one simple page. One simple page. Yes, I do. Anybody else need one? I've got one right here. And again, we will not get through this tonight. I always thought we could. And I'm not teaching Isaiah verse by verse, but we did get through up through chapter 8 and 9. And if you looked on the page one there, Isaiah chapter 2 talks about Jerusalem being lifted up. Again, the nation, you know, the nation being restored, Jerusalem being lifted up, a topographical change. And that's not alone there. That's also in Zechariah. I was going to read that last week, but we'll read it when we get there. Isaiah chapter chapter 4 talks about in that day. That's a phrase. A phrase that refers to not only, you know, contemporary events, but a lot of times pushes it into the future. And I don't want to say some of these prophecies have double meanings, but you have a partial fulfillment in Isaiah's day with an ultimate fulfillment in the end. Like, for example, it talks about Babylon being destroyed, and it is going to fall sometime, but then there's going to be the ultimate falling coming in the future. Chapter 7 talks about a child that will be born. It's going to be called Emmanuel, God with us, born of a virgin. And then chapter 9, there's in chapter 7, 8, 9, there's those verses where the prophet Isaiah goes to the king and asks him, you know, tells him, don't worry about the contemporary situation. We talked about that last week with the Arameans and the Israel of the northern kingdom coming down against him. Just stand firm and ask for a sign. And he was mocking God, wouldn't ask for a sign. So Isaiah said, I'll give you a sign. And says, all these nations are going to be destroyed by the Assyrians, and you'll still be on the throne. You have nothing to worry about. And that also then projected into the future of a king that was going to come. And so now we are in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1 through 10. And I'm going to just start reading through here. And all we're trying to do is just grab some information. Isaiah chapter 11 begins this way. And here it says, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. And again, a stump means a tree has been cut down. And again, at this time in history, when Isaiah is talking, the king is still in the line of David. The Davidic line is still on the throne. When he says a stump, that gives the impression the dynasty has been toppled. Anyway, from his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. And again, remember, coming out of the line of David, out of the line of Jesse, from the line of Judah, coming all the way back to Abraham, there's going to be this seed of the woman that's going to rule the nations with a scepter. Well, it says the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. Now, one thing as we go through this, there's these things that take place. You're going to have prophecies about this Messiah. We'll go ahead and say Messiah, the seed of the woman, the one that's going to come to judge, that we can see that there's some are in this first coming when he came the first time. The Spirit was on him. He had wisdom. He did certain things. But then there's going to be things that he never did that are the second time he comes where he's going to be more of a conqueror. We can basically say the lamb and the lion. You know, that's an easy way of breaking it down. He came and fulfilled the ministry. But when you read Isaiah, the verses sometimes overlap. And it looks like just this is just the Messiah that's coming. And so you can see we would be living here in this church age between the time that the Messiah came, redeemed us, and we've got the first fruits of salvation that we are experiencing. But there's going to come a second coming where we're going to get the full glorification. Now, the whole time through this is Israel is part of this whole thing. Israel, going back into the Old Testament, in Isaiah's day, they're going to be judged. They're going to be set aside. There's going to be a dispersion. We know that in 722, and the kingdom is going to be sent away. This Judah is going to be brought back in 586 so that they're there with the temple during the first coming. But this dispersion that happened in 722 has never ended, and it continues up until sometime where God promises, there's a promise throughout the prophets, and we can see it especially tonight in Isaiah, a promise of a restoration, that Israel cannot save themselves. They've got a hard heart. They keep going away, but they are going to be brought back. They're going to be brought back with the same work the Lamb does that's going to cause the church, the believers, we can even put in here Gentiles, to come and hear and accept Christ, and they're going to get saved. But Israel will maintain a hard heart as a nation. There will be obviously Jews that will join the church, you know, Paul, Peter. But there will not be a national repentance until very near the time of the end. So this is a solid thing. It's promised in all the prophets. We're looking forward to this. So when all we read all of these things in the prophets, and we've got the advantage, if I'm doing this right, this is, you know, and again, this is pretty typical. We've got the advantage of seeing it from this, we're looking at it from this perspective right here. We can see Israel, the judgments that took place in the Old Testament. We can see Israel's reaction to the Messiah the first time, where they're at in history right now. We can see this historically. We got the Gospels, we've got evidence of this taking place, including some of the prophecies Jesus gave coming to pass. And then we're living right here anticipating this. And this is what we call eschatology. But you understand, this whole thing, you can't go teach this eschatology unless you understand you got to come back here to see what's going on. Especially when Isaiah's writing, as we're going to see, we're going to read just verse after verse, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is about Jesus. Oh, this is about Jesus setting up the kingdom. Wait, this is about Israel coming back and being restored. But that didn't take place here. That hasn't even happened yet. But then he's talking about the Gentiles. He's going to be a light to the Gentiles. So some of it's about the Gentiles that's happening now. Some of it's about the land that's already taken place. Sometimes Isaiah is still talking about events happening around 722. And so all of this is put together. And it's once you see this, it's not like, well, you're just picking and choosing, making it say what you want it to say. Well, you can see very clearly. Just kind of watch this as we go through chapter 11. And are we talking about this? Are we talking about the second coming? Are we talking about the restoration of Israel, the promise? Because God is mad at Israel in the book of Isaiah. But he's also saying, I will bring you back. Understand, there's if I say he's mad at Israel, there's nothing they can do. They can only fail. They're not going to... It's like, why don't they fix this? Why don't they start... He says they can't. They've got a hard heart. They need a new heart. They need a new covenant. They need the seed of the woman to come and crush the power of Satan, pay for their sin, and redeem them, and then call them back. That's the only hope Israel's got. That's the only hope the Gentiles have. So it's like they're going to fail, and he knows that, but he knows the Son of God has to come and fix all this. Chapter 11. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From the roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. So this person, he's from Jesse, he's from David, he'll delight in it. He won't be like Israel where he's hard-hearted. He'll delight in these things. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes. I mean, he's not going to judge like a man or decide by what he hears. He won't need a court. You know, what do the jury say? What do they say? But with righteousness, he will judge the needy. With justice, he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. Now, see, there's the judge. In one sense, he's bringing justice. In the other sense, he's bringing judgment. With the breath of his lips, he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be... Now, here's the armor of God. The armor of God in Ephesians or Thessalonians. Righteousness will be his belt, and the faithfulness, the sash around his waist. I mean, sometimes people think Paul's building on this image. Now, all of a sudden, watch this, verse 6. The wolf will lie down with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the goat. Now, we're way past here. Now, we're not here. We're not in the church age. We're not at the second coming. We're not just at the restoration. We're in the kingdom age where he's ruling and reigning. Everything's all set up. We're up and running. The kingdom is there. So, it's all tied together. You can see how, it's not, I don't want to say sloppy, but it's all tied together. And the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, and the young will lie down together. The lion will eat straw like an ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on my holy mountain. My holy mountain is not heaven. My holy mountain is Mount Moriah or Mount Zion. It's Jerusalem. Again, you can argue with that, but it's like if we keep it in context, we're talking about a place on earth. I mean, what you know, all these animals, you know, in heaven, it's like you can go there, but it's like we're talking about bringing restoration where the Garden of Eden was and where man fell. We're talking about restoring that to a place where man is again having dominion on the earth. In that day, verse 10, in that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner. Watch this. For the peoples, plural, the nations will rally to him, and his place of rest will be glorious. Again, so there's the nations. There's always going to be here, not just the restoration of Israel, but the Gentiles. And as you look at this, you can anticipate there's going to be a response from the Gentiles and the nations before Israel is restored. That's going to be a theme throughout this. And again, it happens in history. I don't want to read that into the text, but you can hear that. There's going to be a Gentile response to the Lord before Israel comes back as a nation. Again, these Gentiles can be coming individually through the age of the church, through salvation, but we're talking about Israel. And when he talks about Israel, there's going to be verses about preserving Israel. But then you look at it and go, well, look at all the destruction Israel's gone through during history. I think one way of looking at that is he's not promising individual protection. He's promising, because you can read the verses, he's fulfilling his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm going to make you into a great nation. Now, during this time of rebellion where they've rejected Christ, there may be hardships, there may be individuals that perish, but at the end, Israel's going to still be there to be brought back as a nation, which explains the whole idea of anti-Semitism, of trying to come against the Jews, is one, you can destroy individuals, but God is not going to let the nation of Israel perish from the face of the earth. If that were to happen, you understand what that would mean eschatologically, biblically, as far as the promises. If there is no longer any Israel on the earth, then, well, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to be fulfilled. So Israel is under divine protection, not necessarily individually, but as a nation, they're going to be there. Americans may or may not be individually under God's protection, but I guarantee you, America or any nation, any Gentile nation, is not under God's divine protection with an eternal promise. There may not be, whenever Jesus comes back and sets up the kingdom, there may not be any, what we'd say, Americans living anywhere. There may not be any Canaanites alive today. There may not be any Greeks alive today. There may not be any Egyptians. Again, there's people living in Greece and people living in Egypt. But I guarantee you, there will be on the earth Israelites when Jesus comes back. Does that make sense? I mean, it's like, because that's the promise. Chapter 11, verse 10. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner. Again, standing, banner, rally to him for the peoples. The nations will rally to him. Just like we saw him coming for knowledge, they're rallying to him. And his place of rest will be glorious. They're coming for rest. In that day, again, that's a prophetic phrase, the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people from Assyria. Now, what is this a second time? The first time was he reached into Egypt and brought them out of slavery of Egypt. Now, this is, in a sense, the second Exodus. But notice what's already taken place. The nations are already flooding to him. And in a sense, you can say that's happening. The church, the Gentiles are coming to Christ, but there's going to be a greater movement of the nations towards the Lord before the Lord reaches out a second time. With the first time is Egypt, and grabs his people. And here it says, where is he going to get them from? His people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, that's North and South Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And the islands of the sea would be, of course, Mediterranean islands. You know, you even say Greece and other places going to the west. And that would, in the biblical language, potentially, the islands of the sea is everything unknown to the West, you know, including England, North and South America. That could be, some people read that in, that's not a violation, where the Jews have been scattered all across, even places, islands of places far away we don't know about. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will vanish. Notice Ephraim's jealous, and Judah's enemies will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, nor Judah. And talks about, again, there's the restoration. Oh, I got to read this verse, verse 15. The Lord will drive, this is one of three references to this in the book of Isaiah. The Lord will dry up the gulf of the Egyptian sea with a scorching wind. He'll sweep his hand over the Euphrates River. So there's water in Egypt, and Euphrates is drying up. Now we see Euphrates drying up in the book of Revelation. He'll break it up into seven streams so that men can cross over in sandals. Instead of a big raging river, they can walk across in sandals because it's become seven streams. Now, what that seven streams refers to, be careful with your prophecy teachers, because they can take that seven streams and it can mean anything in the world. You know, it's like, the seven streams. And whatever you want money for in your ministry, you just tie it into these seven streams, and you can be part of those who walk through the waters with your sandals of the seven streams if you give into this ministry, because it's like, what are you saying? It's like, well, okay, you're twisting, you know. So be careful. There's certain things that there's not anything solid. I mean, and maybe there is. But here's the point. He'll break up into seven streams so that men can cross over in sandals. Here it is. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people that is left from Assyria. Remember, 722, they went to Assyria. And the people that are still scattered from the 722 dispersion, there'll be a highway from that were left over from Assyria as there was for Israel when they came up out of Egypt. That's the first mention of the highway. There's going to be this highway. It's going to extend from Egypt going all the way up to Assyria, some kind of super highway. It's going to be called the highway or the way of righteousness. It's going to be like some kind of interstate. If you put it practically, it's some kind of interstate system connecting the continental divide there, where Israel's at, to the east and to the south, and people will just be able to just come to Israel quickly, not by airlines, but by this highway. And it's going to be mentioned in other places. Okay, just keep that in mind. Chapter, if I go to here, look in chapter 40, the next thing on there is chapter 42, 49, and 52. That's where he mentions Gentiles. And again, I'm not going to read those verses right now. In fact, I'm going to flip the page over. But there is, well, here at the bottom of the page, and I've got it crossed off because I want to come over on this page and pick it up later. But right there where it says Isaiah 42, there's three verses talking about God being a light to the Gentiles. These are verses some of the Jews missed. Like when they would call the Gentiles, you know, dogs, they wouldn't have anything to do with the Romans. There's people that, like Paul, got in trouble for going to the Gentiles. And he got in trouble with the Judaizers because you're going to an unclean people. But even going back into Paul's time in school when he had Gamaliel, his teacher, Gamaliel's teachings were heavy on this, that they, the Jews, were to be a light to the Gentiles. And again, that's this ministry. The ministry of Israel is to be a light to the Gentiles. God wanted Israel to do that, to bless them. But it ends up that Israel is, in a sense, not going to be able to do that. And so it's going to be through Israel. It's going to be the Messiah that comes through Israel. And that's going to play into this book of Isaiah also, is there is this concept of the servant. And when you read about the servant of the Lord, some verses make it sound like Israel is the servant of the Lord. And so if you talk to Israelites today, they're going to read those verses as we are the servant of the Lord. But if you read those verses, the servant is going to suffer. The servant is going to die. The servant is going to make many righteous. And Israel says, well, that's us. Well, it's like, well, no, it's not. You were, in a sense, the servant. But because you're human like us, you have failed. But coming through, the prophecy was through Abraham, through that nation, not the nation itself, but through that nation. And that's where the Messiah is going to come. And he is going to be the servant. So some verses make it sound like Israel's the servant. Others, you can see it as the Messiah. And when we get to chapter 53, 52, and 53, talk about the servant of the Lord, and we as Christians, it's clearly Jesus. The Jews will read those exact same verses in their synagogues and teach them, and teach right past this right here, and teach it another way. The servant is either Israel, or the servant, it's Isaiah himself who's suffering, bringing this message, and he's the suffering servant. Even as we go through this, the anointed one is going to become, again, Messiah, but the anointed one is going to be clearly, it's coming up in the book here, Cyrus of the Persians. This one, who wrote on this right there, the Cylinder of Cyrus, where he comes in and conquers Babylon in 538, and then has these decrees written. There's the nations are sent back. Everyone that's taken captive by the Assyrians and the Babylonians are sent back to their homelands. And Cyrus is the anointed one, and he actually builds the temple. You know, he helps finance the rebuilding of the temple, of the Zerubbabel's temple. So he's the anointed one. So when we say, as Christians, Jesus is the servant, they say, you know, Israel's the servant, or they say Isaiah's the servant, and they teach right past that, which is fine, but I disagree. Or when it says the anointed one is going to do these things, we say, well, Jesus was the anointed one. The Spirit came and anointed him and fulfilled those verses. But right there in the text, Cyrus is also called the anointed one. So any verse about Jesus being the anointed one, they twist back and point to Cyrus because he was the one who set the people free, sent them back with finances and helped build the temple. He fulfilled the role of the anointed one. So they don't need Jesus in the book of Isaiah. They've got either Israel or Isaiah, or they've got Cyrus. Does that make sense what I've just said? Because I've got to be careful that when we teach, and you always see things through your own eyes, you know, is a way other people are seeing this. And that's the way the Jews are going to say, it's clear, it's so clear. Well, if you've already got to them, you know, and you've already gone to all of your synagogue classes, and you've got this all ironed out, this is Cyrus, this is Isaiah, this is Israel, and then some Protestant comes trying to evangelize the Jews, and well, it's Jesus. It's like, no, you're a twist, you're adding that to the scriptures. So, I mean, it's clear for us, but for them, it's like, that's part of that idea of they've got blinders on, and there'll be a day in the book of Zechariah where they'll see and they'll mourn for the one they pierced because they realize, oh my gosh, it wasn't Israel or Isaiah, it was the historical man Jesus. It wasn't Cyrus, it was Jesus the Messiah. And then there'll be a national salvation of the people of Abraham. The nation will be saved, and that's what, again, is being promised here. Anyway, in chapter 42 and 49, talk about the Gentiles being saved. Going on down there, I'm not going to read these verses. We'll get to them as we go through. But Isaiah 49, very clearly, Christ will be rejected by, even in the book of Isaiah, the Christ, the anointed one, is rejected by Israel. Isaiah 50, Christ will obey God. We've already seen that referred to earlier. But he's going to do something Israel never could do. He's going to actually obey. Israel was called to obey, but they couldn't do it. Even Isaiah, when he's called, says, I'm a man of unclean lips. It's like, you can't use me. I will fail. So Christ will be the one who will do that. He'll also suffer. Christ will be exalted. And then Isaiah 61, we'll talk about it. So turn the page now. And Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1, going into chapter 12. I'm going to be on in chapter 12. And that's the first thing on page 2. Is the future glory. And we've just gotten into that. You know, everything's dried up. There's a highway. And then chapter 12, verse 1 begins, in that day. That's in that day. Now, again, that day could be in Isaiah's time. That could be, you know, the day the Messiah comes, you know, dies on the cross. It could be most likely the day in the kingdom age when he returns. In that day, I don't know if you can say in specifically the day of the Lord, because when we get to that, the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord, again, this is day of the Lord. This is something that, you know, we'll have to talk about as we get into it, especially when we get to the book of Joel, because they begin to identify this. This day of the Lord can be one, a historical day where God intervenes in history, where like he goes to Egypt, or Sennacherib is destroyed. God just parts the heavens and intervenes in history and resets. You know, it's almost like a miraculous intervention in history. It's like a day of the Lord. The book of Judges, you know, with Deborah, and they went off and they fought the Canaanites. That's a day of the Lord. And again, so you got it in the context. Then the day of the Lord is ultimately that day of wrath. And now that is when we talk about he's bringing judgment. I mean, there's no turning back. He is now unleashing his anger. They're drinking full from the cup of his fury. And this is in Revelations. This is where we tie together the trumpets, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls. And if you're pre-trib, the seven seals. Okay, I say no, but you know. And this is the wrath, and that's exactly what begins in chapter at the sixth seal. Hide us from him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lord. And this right here is confusing because day, it can mean 24 hours, or it can mean now you got the day of the Lord is a 24-hour period. It's like he's got to get, the clock is ticking. It's like he's running out of time, right? Or it can be this period of time or these events. There's this package of events that's going to take place, which ties into this right here, the day of his wrath. It doesn't have to be like this afternoon. It can be like this period of time. And so that's where I find, you know, convenience in that understanding of now, you know, when the Lord appears in the heavens and there's these pouring out. Again, we're looking at these verses, and these verses help, you have to tie them all together. So the day of the Lord would be this wrath. Some people even take the 70th week or that seven-year tribulation period as the day of the Lord. And that can be another way of looking at it. The day of the Lord is, Jesus came and brought salvation. This is the day of salvation for Zacharias, day of salvation for him. So that's a period of time, again, historically, but eschatologically, we just don't want to trip on something and misapply it, but we're not worried about that if it's already taken place. And I think this is, the 70th week is kind of an overstatement. The day of the Lord is not the day of the Antichrist, because that's the Antichrist bringing persecution on the believers. Now, if it's the church who hasn't been raptured, or if the church has been raptured, then these other people, whoever got saved right away and became these super Christians and stand in the face of the Antichrist, good luck for them. Yeah, get more power to them. That's the day of the Antichrist, the day of persecution. The day of the Lord is when this Antichrist is like, you are now being judged. And it's going to be a period of time. It might be a week, it might be a month, it might be, 3 years, however you want to put it. So that would be when it says the day of the Lord. And so that is not specifically, I would not say the day of the Lord is equal to in that day. I would think in that day would be, if we have the time scale, in that day is up here in all of these events. And within that day, there's going to be the day of the Lord is going to be up here in that day. Because in that day, there will also be things that will continue into the millennium in that day. So yeah, those are, and as we go, if those definitions aren't accurate, we need to make them accurate. You understand what I mean? That's how I'm approaching it. But these prophets are going to be building on each other, and so you should hear some consistency through Isaiah into Daniel into Paul, or Jesus and Paul, and then in the book of Revelation. But in that day, I will praise you, O Lord, although you are angry with me. Your anger has turned away, and you have comforted me. Surely God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. The Lord, then it says the Yahweh, or Yahweh twice, is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. With joy, you will draw water from the wells of salvation. In that day, you will say. Now notice, this is a salvation that is not available for Israel or humanity at this time, because the servant hasn't come yet. In that day, you'll be able to draw water out of the wells of salvation. Right now, it's like you don't even know what it is. You can't tap into this because the Christ has come. I'm giving you a promise in that day. Then in verse 4, in that day, you'll say, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known among the nations what he has done, and proclaim that his name is exalted. Sing to the Lord, for he has done glorious things. Let this be known to all the world. Shout aloud and sing for joy, people of Zion, for great is the Holy One of Israel among you. Now, obviously, that verse could be read and recognized any time in history, but this is a particular day where it's actually manifested. They are like, this is some crazy times. Chapter 13, an oracle concerning Babylon. Isaiah, son of Amos, saw, raise a banner on a bare hill. And now what we've got here is this, and I'm not going to necessarily read through all of this, but this is interesting, and Marilyn's asked about this before, and I think we addressed it a little bit last week, it seems like. I don't know if it was after class. Babylon, when Isaiah's writing in let's say, 730 to 700, 701, when Sennacherib came, the Assyrians are the rising power, and they're the ones that are destroying northern Israel and are destroying the fortified cities in Judah. So Assyrians, the power. They're going to be overthrown by the Babylonians in the Battle of Carchemish when Nebuchadnezzar comes up in like 605 B.C. The Babylonians are going to take out the Assyrians. Babylon is going to rule until 538 when Cyrus comes in and the Persians overthrow the Babylonians. Now, what happens, the Persians don't destroy Babylon. So you could say this happened, this chapter was fulfilled in 538 when the Persians destroyed Babylon. They didn't destroy Babylon, they took over the Babylonian Empire and they moved into the city of Babylon. They moved into the palace. you know, Daniel probably, you know, kept maintained his living conditions, and he just had it. He just started reporting to Cyrus and Darius as the Persian. He just switched from, he used to be up here. Daniel would have been up in here with Jeremiah, a prince in the land of Judah. He got taken captive, and he became a prince in the kingdom of Babylon. And he lived there the whole kingdom time, the whole time he's in Babylon. And then as an old man, he now, well, now I work for the Persians. You talk about being deep state government employee. He's in Judah, Babylon. Now he's working. He's back from Nixon's administration. Now he's still working in the Oval Office for Trump. It's like Daniel just never went away. So, I mean, that's exactly what happened. So the point, Babylon didn't get, and even the Greece, when Greece comes in, Alexander the Great just kind of continues to move into these places, and the Greeks take over for a period of time, and then, of course, comes the Romans. So Babylon, when we read about the fall of Babylon, this is the question. There was never this vast, this destruction. It happened overnight where the kingdom got turned over, but there's not a destruction. And they talk, we read in the Bible, and again, I don't have an answer for this. It's one of those things you don't want to, it doesn't make complete sense. I mean, it's fine. There's nothing wrong, not contradictory. But you got to kind of let it sit and look at it, because Babylon was never overthrown in a day. I mean, it just sudden destruction like Sodom. Just boom, it's gone, because it just kind of fade. Even in the New Testament, there's still activity there. Now you go there now, and like Saddam Hussein tried to rebuild it. If he's trying to fulfill Bible prophecy, I'm not sure what he was trying to do. He tried to rebuild it, and it's still in the middle of the desert, the actual city. But, you know, there's just not it's not the center of world economics. And so we've got these prophecies that are still hanging out there that really haven't been fulfilled. Yet Babylon is gone, you know, the city, but yet the prophecies weren't fulfilled exactly the same. So some, and when you get into the, you know, in Revelation, fallen is Babylon the Great. Well, Peter, he writes about Babylon, or Babel. Yeah, Babylon. But people don't think he's writing to Babylon. He's writing about the Christians in Rome and is using Babylon as a code name for Rome. And that's pretty solid. And so that means now Babylon is no longer Babylon. It's where the power of the world's empire is. Well, now could it be now New York, for example? Or could it be, you know, some other place in the world? Could it be, you know, where? Is there a place we don't know yet? See, that's the thing I'm hanging on to. It's like, I don't know if we know the answer where this, you know, the world power is going to be based at when Babylon falls in Revelation. Is it? It could circle back and actually become Babylon. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, it could. It doesn't look like it, but you go back to this. I've mentioned this before too. You go back to the 1500s during the Protestant Reformation, or the 1700s when they're trying to explain end time prophecy, and you've got Israel being brought back into the land. And it's kind of like, well, that can't mean Israel because there's no Israel. It must mean the church. And so they screwed up their eschatology, and they're still holding on to the 1500s and 1700s. And that's when a few years ago I tried to teach at a church here in town, and they found out I was teaching end times. And they said, well, we don't believe it that way. I said, you think it's already taken place? And that the church is Israel? They says, well, I said, man, you're like 500 years behind theologically, because I mean, Israel's back, you know. But you can't blame them. Now you can't blame them in the 1500s and the 1700s when they say, well, Israel can't mean Israel, because I mean, can you imagine the world economics being centered in ancient Babylon today? It's like, no, it's a deserted. No, it must mean New York. Okay, that's fine. But you may be setting a trap for yourself when all of a sudden it goes back to Babylon. Again, I don't see that happening, but neither did anybody in the 1500s and the 1700s say, someday Israel is going to be one of the most powerful, influential nations in the modern history. It's like, no. Those prophecies are all talking about the church. And then they build their eschatology on that, and now today, you're either stuck in that, or you've got to say, well, we got to make some adjustments. You understand what I'm saying? It's like, this doesn't make sense to me right here, some of these verses. Now, I'm not disagreeing with them. I'm just saying you got to be careful. But anyway, that's where am I at? Chapter 13. And I think all those points right there, point A, point B, but also in the day of the Lord, Yahweh, possibly also Revelation 8. It was partially fulfilled by Cyrus, but not completely. Okay, that's enough of that right there. Now go to chapter 14. And this is now, see, chapter 13 is, well, an oracle concerning Babylon. Raise a banner on the bare hilltop, shout to them, beckon to them to enter the gates. And it seems like, and if that's Cyrus, but also seems like something more is taking place. But you see in verse 17, you got clear reference to the Medes. See, he says in chapter 13, verse 17, I will stir up against them, Babylon, the Medes, who do not care for silver and have no delight for gold. Their bows, and goes through and talks about them. But then here's the problem. Verse 19, Babylon, the jewel of the kingdoms, the glory of the Babylonians' pride, will be overthrown by God like Sodom and Gomorrah. She'll never be inhabited or lived in through all generations. No Arab will pinch his tent there. It's like, well, wait a minute. At first, at verse 17, oh, it must be Cyrus. By the time you get to verse 19, it's like, what? It's like people lived there for generations after, you know, Cyrus got there. Chapter 14, Israel now is going to be taunting Babylon, which is interesting because now this is pushing us way on the other side of history where Israel's now restored, they're in position, and they're looking back at the destruction of Babylon. Almost like they've gone through the book of Revelation, they've been restored, they're in the kingdom looking back at Babylon, who was the center of the beast kingdom, the Antichrist kingdom, and destroying the earth. And now, well, chapter 14, verse 1, the Lord will have compassion on Jacob. Once again, he will choose Israel and will settle them in their own land. Now remember, this is before, being written before 722, before Israel's dispersed, before they went into Babylonian captivity. This is being written before Babylon overthrew the Assyrians. And so, you know, now Israel's being brought back, but Israel's not even gone yet. They're being brought back, and they're going to be mocking Babylon, who hasn't even taken over the Assyrians yet, and the Persians haven't shown. I mean, it's like, this is so far out in front. Aliens will join them and unite with the house of Jacob. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. That's the Gentiles. And the house of Israel will possess the nations as men servants and maid servants in the Lord's land. That'd be half be Israel. Doesn't mean heaven. It could. People say it does. They'll make captives of their captors and rule over the oppressors. On that day, the Lord gives you relief from suffering and turmoil and cruel bondage. You will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. So their suffering, their turmoil, their cruel bondage is gone. Israel's back and they're mocking Babylon, saying, how the oppressor has come to an end, how his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers, which in anger struck down peoples with unceasing blows and in fury subdued nations. Anyway, that's just talking about that. And that almost can sound like they're talking about the rulers of the heavenly realm, almost like Satan himself. In fact, look in verse 9. The grave below is all astir to meet you at your coming. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you, giving the impression that like when Jonah went down to the gates of Hades, was at the very bars of gates of Hades, people enter into Hades. Now, as people die or the great world leaders die and are departing, go into Hades or Sheol, the underworld, waiting for judgment, people rouse, you know, the dead, they come and see, ooh, who's this famous person that's now dead and entered into the underworld? I mean, there's consciousness there. Anyway, it's just the grave or Sheol below is all astir. So all the dead souls in Sheol are alert, awake, to meet you at your coming. Now, again, this almost sounds like, you know, someone famous, world powers going into the grave. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you. Well, right there. I mean, that's what says it very clear. All those who were leaders in the world, it makes them rise from their thrones, almost like they're trying to recreate who they were in the underworld. All those who were kings over the nations, they will all respond. They will say to you, you have become weak as we are. Then they may have thrones, but they still know they're weak. They're in the land of darkness and shadows. There's nothing really there. I mean, as far as in the historical value. You become weak. You become like us. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave along with the noise of your harps. Maggots are spread out beneath you and worms cover you. Jesus said the worms will never die. The fire is never quenched. Now this is very clearly, now watch it. Now again, we're off subject, but chapter 14, verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star. son of the dawn. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low nations. You said in your heart, and here's the five I wills of Satan, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, which could refer to the angelic host. I will sit enthroned on the mount of the assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. That would be God's throne. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit. This would be the crushing of the power, the seed of the woman, crushing the power of Satan or the serpent. Those who see you stare at you and they ponder your fate. Is this the man who shook the earth? Now again, the man, it's not Satan, now it's a man. Is this like the Antichrist? As we go through this, this is going to be the king of Tyre. Historically, this is the king of Tyre, but there's clearly something taking place behind the scenes here. In other words, we're off subject there, but that's the taunting of Babylon. And so we got up to verse 14. We're going to pick up in chapter 32 next week, and then we start talking about the king of Israel. I do want you to slip down on your notes right there and where it says Isaiah 49 through 57. You see the numbers, 49 through 57. That says, focuses on Israel's restoration, the suffering servant who will accomplish the deliverance. Beginning in chapter 49, we're now talking about Israel being restored. But to identify Israel's restoration, they have to first identify the servant, the seed of the woman who's going to come and suffer. Well, it's Jesus Christ. And because of his work, then Israel's going to be able to return and be restored. And you see how those details are written down right there. And so anyway, that's that. I'll pick that up next week. I'll pray. And anybody got a question or a comment? I don't want to dominate, but I do. I do want, if there's anything that didn't make sense, I'll pray and then you can get up and leave. But if anyone's got a question, I'd certainly got a clarification. Does this make sense at all? I mean, kind of like, and hopefully laying a foundation so we don't get too crazy. Maybe uncover some things we haven't seen before. Father, we do thank you again for the truth you've given to us. We thank you for your word. We do ask that we'd handle these things correctly, that we would not add things to the scriptures or even take away the things that you've revealed to us, but we would embrace it and understand it. We do thank you for your spirit that brings us to light and also teachers that have come into our lives and surround us in books and videos and in our churches that can explain these things and bring us again into your truth that we may understand the things of God. We ask that we may be empowered to be your witnesses at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.